You're listening to the home of cool, irreverent, and entertaining talk right here on LA Talk Radio. You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Dr. Melody Fox right here on LA Talk Radio.
Well, welcome to another edition of Answers for the Family. I am your host today, Dr. Melody Fox. The other co-host, Alan Cardoza, unfortunately, is out of the country on business and hopefully a little pleasure in the meantime, but he will be back with us next week. As each week, we will bring you guests that can inspire, educate, and entertain while bringing answers and options to raising children today and in our constantly changing future. We will address issues such as locating your runaway teen, family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, dealing with addictions, parenting, self-care, and so much more. With each of us having over 30 years' experience working with families in crisis, we have been fortunate to meet and work with some of the top professionals in this field who are all working to make this world a better place for all of us. We will bring you some of these incredibly talented and caring people each week as we bring to you Answers for the Family. Now, today's topic, we are going to be talking about the open community model of care, a non-traditional approach to addiction treatment where rehab meets reality. As for many chronic relapsing addicts and alcoholics, the biggest challenge is not the stopping, it's staying stopped once they leave the safe and structured confines of a residential treatment and go back home to their family, work, and friends, and the daily demands of caring for their families as well as themselves. Now, our guest today is Bob Ferguson. He is the founder and CEO of Jay Walker Lodge. It's a non-traditional but highly effective treatment program located in Carbondale, Colorado, which believes that the key to lasting sobriety after rehab is to foster an environment of challenge and choice in early recovery, in contrast to the industry's traditional emphasis on containing their clients and focusing more on the consequences of their disease. So, Bob, welcome to Answers for the Family.
Melody, thank you for having me.
Well, we're thrilled to have you today because, you know, sobriety is something that affects the whole family. It's just not the person going through sobriety or going through rehab. It really affects everybody. And I think, you know, the traditional models, a lot of them work really well and do great work, but I've known so many people who have been addicts that come home and back into the real world, and you know, there's all these daily life stressors, and they don't quite have the practice and the tools of dealing with it, and it's easy for them to relapse. So I was just curious, you know, what is an open community model of care, and what does that mean?
Well, when Jay Walker was opened a little over 7 years ago, we took our roots from my own story of recovery. And I think you see this a lot in our field with addiction treatment centers. You know, as often as not, you'll find they're opened by people in recovery who have had their own struggles. And in my case, I was a guy in my 20s who had a history of relapse followed by rehab followed by relapse. And I would find myself with my family wringing their hands on the sidelines, hoping that this time when he came back, you know, Bobby would be well-behaved and follow his aftercare and sort of toe the line of sobriety. Unfortunately, what I found in my own experience was that I did very well in rehab. I actually began with an outpatient program, and I'd been recommended to go to an inpatient program, but assured all the people that cared about me that I would be fine. Sure enough, I didn't have the structure that I needed in outpatient to stay sober. So having failed there, I agreed to go to my first residential treatment. And I wouldn't get sober for good until 3 residential treatments and 5 years later. Mm-hmm. And so Jay Walker was opened with that guy in mind, the guy who does well in rehab and struggles afterwards. And what I found, the difference between the treatment episode that lasted and worked and the ones before it, was that while a safe, secluded timeout from your life is often necessary for an addict in early recovery, if you remove the choice to screw up and put a guy in too safe of a sanctuary, at least in my case, I was not equipped to deal with all the distractions, the people, places, and things that would distract me from my sobriety once I left that safe place.
Mm-hmm.
So Jaywalker Lodge is a community-based program, and there are others emerging like it, and there have been some wonderful programs through the years, so we by no means have a corner on this market. But the principle is that if you put a recovering addict in the midst of an open community, you know, put him on Main Street instead of up on a mountaintop somewhere, and offer him a daily choice to stay sober in recovery and to stay in treatment on a daily basis,
mm-hmm.
you've in effect, what you've done is you've created a more of a high-risk, high-reward situation for that addict. And what we've found is that for guys with a history of previous treatments followed by relapse, the key is not to just stash him away in a safe sanctuary for a longer timeout, but to have a short timeout followed by a daily opportunity to make either a healthy or an unhealthy choice while providing accountability and structure of treatment at the same time.
Now, I know what you have, the open community model of care is designed, as you had mentioned, people with history of previous treatments and a relapse. What is the average amount of relapse that somebody has before they decide to go to your model or that really get into recovery?
Yeah, it's an interesting notion, because what happens, the model itself is defined. It's a great question. You're asking sort of about our client profile. What's this guy look like who shows
mm-hmm.
up at Jaywalker Lodge? And in our case, he's 26 to 27 years old. It's all in men. We have a minimum 90-day length of stay. And then there are follow-on programs in 90-day segments. So the longest a guy could stay in treatment at Jaywalker would be if he came for 90 days and then stayed for a transitional program for another 90 days, and then there's an outpatient program if he decides to stay longer for another 90 days, and many of our guys stay in the community after that. So 2 to 3 previous treatments is our client profile. We rarely or if ever take a guy in his first treatment.
Why is that?
Well, because what we found is that I need to back up a little bit and make a distinction between what we call our level of care. This open community model is often referred to in our business and in the treatment world as extended care treatment. And that's as opposed to what we often call primary care treatment. So primary is what people most conventionally think about going to rehab. That's your Hazelden, your Betty Ford, your Sierra Tucson, your 30-day campus-based, safe, secluded timeout from your life. This is a place, primary care, which we feel is very important. We don't provide that level of service, but in primary care, it's about stopping the active addiction. So you need a safe, secluded setting.
Mm-hmm.
And in primary care, what you'll often find the focus is on medical detoxification, stabilizing the patient, assessing any pathology. You know, is there a co-occurring mental health issue going on
mm-hmm.
in addition to the addiction? And there's a lot of education. So there tends to be a real focus on just not getting drunk, not getting high, one day at a time in a really safe setting.
Mm-hmm.
In extended care, which is what Jaywalker is, this is a different level where you're, instead of arresting the addiction, and instead of stopping active addiction, you're starting life in recovery. Well, how are you going to start your life in recovery in a safe, secluded campus removed from community? You're not. You're going to basically just be not drinking. So instead of a focus on education, which you have in primary care, there's a focus more on applying what you've learned. Instead of the whole program being focused on the relationship with the counselor and the client, the focus shifts to your peer group. So there's all these shifts that happen when you go from primary, which is about stopping active addiction, to extended care, which is about initiating new life in recovery. And that's why we believe that primary needs to happen in those safe, secluded settings. But if you really want to initiate real life and real recovery, you need to take that rehab setting and extend it and put it right into a real community.
Now, it almost sounds like you're sober living plus care, as opposed to going from a primary care setting or inpatient treatment to going right back into the community, your own community, or a sober living home where they just hope that you go to groups and et cetera a few times a week and start your life again, or going straight back home without much support except for maybe occasional outpatient therapy and family therapy. So it sounds like you're in between that. How does that work? Like once
well,
they leave
you. It's a great question. And what is the difference then between sober living and this thing we're calling extended care? I think one of the myths that people feel about treatment is that there's several things. There is a high level of clinical intensity and acuity in the disease that gets addressed in certain extended care settings, even in an open community model, which belies the traditional concepts about sober living. Sober living emerged really as sort of just this landlord-tenant relationship predicated on sobriety. You've been to treatment, now it's time to go out and live with some other sober guys and just go to meetings, don't drink, and maybe check in with the counselor once in a while. Mm-hmm. There is a definite value to that level of care. But what Jaywalker's model says is that there's something very important that has to happen in terms of intensive therapy, work with others, accountability and structure between primary and that level of sober living. And so this is that gap. I think the best way to say it is that instead of being a safe, secluded timeout from life's distractions, we believe that relapsing alcoholics need a structured, hectic reentry into real life. Mm-hmm. So instead of containment, they need challenge. And I think that's the part of our approach that's a little bit non-traditional. We believe that guys with a history of relapse, of doing well in rehab and badly afterwards, can handle more of the real world than their families and their doctors and their caregivers traditionally have given them credit for. Mm-hmm. We've found that our guys are aching to prove to the world that they're not screw-ups, that if you give me a chance to make a positive choice, I will do it. I will surprise you with what I can accomplish earlier in recovery than anybody thought I could. I just need the accountability of a peer group while I'm doing it, because if you just cut me loose, that's too little accountability and I'm not able to handle it.
Right. Now, I know your program focuses on working with men. Do you know of any specific similar programs that work with women?
Sure. There's wonderful programs like Jaywalker. There's a terrific program in Costa Mesa, California called Safe Harbor.
I'm very familiar with Safe Harbor. Wonderful program.
Right, run by Velvet Mangan. And, mm-hmm. and interestingly, the programs that I like the most tend to take on some of the story and authenticity of the struggles of their founders. So Velvet's story is not unlike my own in terms of, you know, she was literally loved into recovery by a powerful group of recovering women and has created that into her model. Mm-hmm. You'll find in these programs, there's another wonderful one called Inner Harbor, in DeCuesta, Florida, and that's run by Laura Kiley. They tend to treat a little older client profile than Safe Harbor. So you've got Safe Harbor out west and Inner Harbor in Florida. The interesting thing is that if you create an authentic space of healing and stay true to something in your own story, you find that if you pay attention to the people that show up in that space, both as staff and as clients, you can create something really exceptional. And what that's a fancy way of saying those three programs that we've talked about, Jaywalker for the men and Safe Harbor and Inner Harbor for the women, tend to rely heavily on not staff, not medical expertise, but a bunch of alumni who stick around the program afterwards. Mm-hmm. That's secret magic ingredient. And that's what I think as a parent and as a family, you really want to look for. When you're looking at programs to help transition someone you love into recovery. Remember, treatment is different from recovery. Treatment is safe. Recovery is a little bit dangerous. And that's that slippery slope. And when you're looking for those programs to transition, ask about and investigate, what does that alumni community look like? How much are they a part of the program? Do they drive the patients to meetings? Do they show up and eat meals with the patients? Because your alumni are not just representatives of your program, they're products of your program's sobriety and its effectiveness. So while parents are at home worried about containing the downside, alumni are in the building talking about optimizing the upside. Mm-hmm. Alumni are about the hope. They get your kids excited. They say, I did it, you can do it too. And it's the last thing that families are looking for. They want to know how much medical expertise, who's on the board, what is the cotton thread count in the sheets, how good is the executive chef. You want to know about the alumni community, because they're the ones that are going to carry the person you love, into a safe space when they transition.
Now, what is the age range that you work with?
We're licensed by the state of Colorado to treat men 18 and over.
Okay.
We do get guys, all the way. At our first level of care, we have 23 beds. Mm-hmm. And our average age will be between 26, 27, 28. But there'll be a couple of 40-year-olds, a couple of 50-year-old guys in there, and a couple of guys, below 23. We try to keep, we don't allow our peer group to have more than 8 guys under the age of 23, because there is a certain level of stability and motivation that we need in order to safely navigate the perils of Main Street recovery. So, a jaywalker is a guy in the lore of Alcoholics Anonymous and in the recovery community. That's kind of a nickname for that particularly stubborn kind of relapsing alcoholic who has a good understanding of their problem and yet a bad track record of staying sober. So it's almost by definition hard to become a true jaywalker until you've been through the ringer a little bit, until you're, there are some 19 and 20-year-old jaywalkers out there, but by and large, you almost need to be in your middle 20s before you even qualify for this last stop on the railroad.
So I take it that's where the name of Jaywalker Lodge came from.
It is. That is the story behind it. So you'll go to an AA meeting or a 12-step community, and you'll hear a guy from time to time identify himself as a jaywalker. That has nothing to do with Jaywalker Lodge. That has to do with a parable in the basic text of Alcoholics Anonymous that describes this particularly stubborn kind of alcoholic who keeps jumping in front of fast-moving traffic, thinking the rules don't apply to me, and I can get across safely to the other side. That's part of the thinking that says this time it'll be different. If I switch from beer to wine, it'll be different. If I maybe just smoke a little pot instead of drinking, I won't have as many consequences. Mm-hmm. But in the end, that poor jaywalker keeps getting run over by a fast-moving trolley.
Right. And I know quite a few jaywalkers, and I have a few in my practice that come in, and I never really thought of them as jaywalkers before, but they definitely fit the profile that you're talking about. But they've kind of overstayed their welcome at a lot of different sober living facilities, and it's getting harder and harder to find a place for them.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because what you find is there needs to be more, I think, to early sobriety than just, kind of crossing another day off the calendar and talking about, the drugs I didn't use today. And and in order to, I suppose the most controversial part about what we do at Jaywalker, and I think you're seeing more treatment centers embrace this, is the notion that we believe that in order to achieve lasting and sustainable sobriety, clients must learn to manage an environment that offers a daily choice between relapse or recovery. In other words, that's a long-winded way of saying without relapse on the table, true recovery isn't possible. You got to give the guy a choice. And what we've learned almost by accident is they can handle it better than you think if you just create a container that's based on positive peer pressure rather than walls, windows, and door alarms.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I, I was just thinking, too, as you were talking about, you know, some of these places, I really wish they would give my jaywalkers a chance to come back again. But a lot of times, it's like one time you're out, that's it. And I also think for some people, relapse is part of the recovery process. Not that I'm big on people relapsing, but it happens. And so where are you going to go from now? And if you keep getting kicked out and shamed by your relapse, I think it's hard to move forward.
You're absolutely right. I'll throw the other side of the coin out there. It's an interesting paradox, because you're not going to take someone else's word from their experience in your life. I mean, a 23-year-old doesn't show up on your doorstep particularly interested in your opinion about his life to begin with.
Right.
So you're already got a guy who's been conditioned culturally and otherwise, you know, to say, look, I got myself into this, I'll get myself out of it. And becoming interested in other people's opinions about what I should do with my life was the number one most difficult thing. Well, one thing that got me to listen to other people was my own relapses, which speaks to your point. So relapse is a very valuable teaching tool, because it teaches us lessons we can't learn any other way. The problem with these communities and that you're talking about, these sober livings and, you know, and Jay Walker Lodge is no exception. At the end of the day, you have to have a pretty firm value system. And one of the values that we've embraced is that the wants and needs of any individual are outweighed by the safety and welfare of the community at large. And that's just another way of saying that even a guy who has a therapeutic relapse, in other words, is teachable, has put himself in a position of learning from his relapse, wants to get back into the treatment program, cannot be readmitted, because in our environment, what you have, the entire container, the entire safety net of a program that's based in community with relapse as an option every day, all you have is the credibility and the strength of the peer group. Mm-hmm. And when a peer goes out, makes a choice, you know, has a relapse, we have other levels of care they can go into, we have referrals that we can give them, but they no longer have credibility in the peer group. And plus, we're dealing with chronic relapsing guys who will quickly interpret one guy's being forgiven as they get a free pass too.
Mm-hmm.
And so you end up with some pretty harsh feeling, shame, almost shaming pronouncements around relapse when you love the guy, you know he's sincere, and yet you can't bring him right back into that peer group, because, you know, it's not just about the deterrent, it's about the strength and credibility of your container is based on credibility in the peer group. So,
With that in mind,
tough call.
I know it's a tough call. And I'm just curious, though, with that in mind, I was just wondering, are there any thing that somebody who has relapsed can do to earn the right to come back into the program?
Sure. We call it back on the beam. And there's always a back on the beam. Back on the beam can be 10 days spent at one of our partner programs. There's a number of terrific programs in and outside the state of Colorado that will work with us to take a peer who has relapsed, put him on a post-relapse track, where they take a look at their part, their thinking leading up to it. Basically, we put him back into one of those primary care settings for 10 days to 2 weeks to evaluate what happened and to restore their credibility. It shows the peers that we've got a guy here who's willing to go to any lengths to get back into that group, mm-hmm. and then they can be readmitted back into the program. And I think a lot of these extended care community-based programs like Jaywalker do put provisions to get guys back into a safe space where they can arrest their addiction once again and restore the credibility that they have with the group while they're doing it.
Yeah, and that's wonderful, and especially to know what they can do too, and that sets up the expectation for them.
Right, and nobody wants to do that, so we're not worried that it creates some weak deterrent or something, because mm-hmm. nobody wants to have to leave the group and do that. But if they are willing to, then very often we get a great outcome with those guys.
Sure. And today we're talking to Bobby Ferguson. He's the founder and CEO of Jay Walker Lodge in Colorado. And the topic today is the open community model of care, a non-traditional approach to addiction treatment where rehab meets reality. We'll be back in just a moment with more Answers for the Family as we take a quick break. So stand by.
Founded over 25 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, West Shields specializes in resolving adolescent issues that negatively impact the family. From preteen to young adult, we are experienced and qualified to help. We offer solutions which include referrals to a network of top professionals internationally that we work very closely with in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, and psychiatry. Our in-home crisis intervention care program helps to stabilize families and bring effective resolution. We are supported by our licensed investigation company that enables us to offer legal and expert services for locating runaway teens and more. Our therapeutic transportation services help to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely provided transportation to specialized schools and programs with unmatched experience and success. Simply put, West Shield Adolescent Services is the best solution when your family is facing personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585 and let us help you.
And we're back to Answers for the Family. I am your host today, Dr. Melody Fox, and with me is our guest, Bobby Ferguson. He is the founder and CEO of Jay Walker Lodge in Carbondale, Colorado, and we're talking about the open community model of care, where the non-traditional approach to addiction treatment is where rehab meets reality. And before we took a break, we were talking about people leaving or relapsing and what they would need to do to get back. Now, I was just curious, are there some clients who would not do well in the open community model at all?
Yeah, that's a great question, Melody. And absolutely, it is a high-risk, high-reward proposition. So the screening criteria for pre-admission are really important. And it's an interesting paradox that we would be treating a guy who has a terrific history of relapse, chronic acuity, very often co-occurring mental health issues. And yet at the same time, we say we're looking for a stable and motivated client. And it's sort of, that appears to be an apparent contradiction. But what we do in our pre-admissions is essentially look for red flags that may signal, a difficult outcome or a bad outcome in our environment. And I guess the best way to cut right to the chase and say who would do well and who isn't is any guy that we can identify access to issues, in other words, personality disorders, is going to struggle in our environment, even though we see and are very effective with guys that have other mental health dual diagnosis issues. So I guess what I'm saying is in every case, we look for addiction as the primary diagnosis. And if there are a secondary diagnosis, such as, depression, bipolar, anxiety, all of those are managed and treatable. In our environment, we have a clinical psychologist, we have an addiction psychiatrist on board. We are equipped to deal with that. However, when you get into certain categories of mental health diagnoses, which include narcissism, personality disorders, the access to borderline issues present big problems for us, because it's a complicated idea, but we rely on what we call an intrinsic positive peer pressure container. The guy who does not care about what people in the world and people in his peer group think about him, which is typical of a borderline or a narcissist, don't do well because we can't get them to honor and care about our container. So they do need an isolated setting. They need a therapeutic alliance, one-on-one, building trust with a counselor in a safe and secluded setting apart from the mainstream community. Mm-hmm. So that would be an example of a guy that we would say. Another guy is a guy who is too fresh off of a relapse. In other words, just because we don't provide that primary level doesn't mean that a guy doesn't need it before he gets to us. So maybe it can be an abbreviated stay in a primary setting, but we believe you do need a safe, secluded setting to stop the addiction before you start the recoveries. Guys who try to go straight from active addiction into our setting can often be triggered by the setting itself.
Mm-hmm. Now, as far as going into your setting and you're starting the early recovery process, I know there's a therapeutic value to service, and I understand that your clients are heavily involved in a lot of local and national community service programs. How does that work in your program, and why?
Yeah, it's got a couple of benefits. One thing that we've found, you know, we've been blessed by the community that we operate in. We have the three largest buildings on Main Street in Carbondale are occupied by our program and by our clients. Carbondale is a small mountain town, sort of situated about halfway between Aspen and Vail on the western slope of the Colorado Rockies. It's an ideal adventure-based setting for a young man to have a life do-over, and a great place. Many of our men who successfully complete our program decide to stick around afterwards because, you know, they don't have a wife and two kids waiting for them back in Toledo, and there's no business partner anxiously waiting for them to get back to work. It's time to start their new life in sobriety. So we have been, I think, beneficiaries of an open-hearted community in Carbondale. They look our men in the eyes. They give them jobs. But we've done our part as well by we have our men heavily involved in local service. We feed the homeless. We're involved in Habitat for Humanity. We build playgrounds in the community. Our men are routinely in and out of the six local school districts carrying a message about, to kids in high school and middle school about making good choices when they were younger and the consequences of their choices that they've made. We routinely are involved in what we call service missions, where we will get in a van and or an airplane even and cross the country to help out with Hurricane Katrina for a week. We were in Des Moines, Iowa, where they had flooding. We've spent every year, twice a year, we send guys out to South Dakota, Pine Ridge, Lakota Reservation, which has the single highest poverty and alcoholism rates in the country, and they'll winterize homes and help to try to build infrastructure out there. And, you know, generally we tend to treat a guy who comes from educated, affluent families who've gotten all the breaks, made some bad choices, you know, ended up on the wrong side of the tracks, but have no idea how fortunate they are to be, you know, stood by, loved, cared for, while you know, many of the folks we get to, the homeless and the folks that we get to work with, give them a new take on their problems, their struggles, what they can be grateful for. So not only are we trying to repay a debt to our local community for being open-hearted enough to embrace our men and look them in the eye, but there's an immense therapeutic benefit to getting out of yourself into action and being of service to somebody else.
And I think that's important, because when you get lost in your addiction, it's all about you. And when you get out of yourself and be of service to others, all of a sudden it's about other people. And there's kind of a high that comes from that, too. That feels really good.
Right. And it's certainly nothing that Jaywalker Lodge has this is a cornerstone of all good treatment. But the fortunate part for Jaywalker is that, you definitely, our men develop self-esteem by doing small, esteemable acts, by being a little more thoughtful and a little more considerate, and recognizing how much they've taken from their community, and by consciously trying to give something back. But what's neat is that if you're located on Main Street in a little community, we don't have to go out and architect and engineer and create and contrive programs for therapeutic benefit. We just sign up for the stuff that's already going on in our community. And this is what I'm so excited about in getting other treatment providers to jump on this stuff, is that, you know, if you're located in some safe, secluded setting and you want to create a program for your clients, you pretty much have to bring the mountain to Muhammad. But if you're located in the middle of a vibrant and active community that's already clearing brush off of trails or has an adopt a highway program, and every community has a Habitat for Humanity, all you got to do is plug your guys in. So you're providing program, but you're not creating infrastructure to do it. And all of a sudden, they're shoulder to shoulder with people in the local community. Not only are they doing service, they're feeling normal. They're feeling like, boy, I'm not such a freak. I'm actually cleaning the highway and helping the community alongside the people that live in it. So it's easy for the treatment center to plug the guys into, and the community appreciates it.
And that's wonderful when they're there. And then you mentioned some of the people that aren't attached or have commitments in another part of the world might stay there and continue with that model of what's going on there. How do you encourage, or do you encourage, that involvement in local community services to your clients to continue when they return home to their own communities?
It's interesting. What we're finding is, I mean, this is one of the things, I'll be honest with you, Melody. We opened up a 90-day residential treatment center with a focus on step one. Mm-hmm. We felt that men relapsed after treatment for many reasons, but the one thing they all had in common was a failure to really personalize and embrace in a meaningful and a relevant way the true surrender of step one of the 12 steps, which says, you know, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol or drugs and that our lives had become unmanageable. So that was the premise with which we opened. What happened was, after a while, we were finding not just that a few, but most, I'm talking 80% of the guys who completed our program weren't going home. Mm-hmm. So while we thought we were going to create a package of content and lessons and therapy so compelling that they could zip it up in their suitcase and bring it back home with them, what we found ourselves doing is, you know, we're really in an 80 to 90% stick around town mode these days. So yes, there are guys that go back home, but typically we advise against it. We have a lot of compelling reasons to stick around, but if a guy's married or if he's got a wife and two kids, absolutely they have to go home. That's the whole point of getting sober. They've got obligations and, connections and responsibilities back home. So we do help them plug in. And I think part of what we try to do is just ask them to continue to engage in the same. In other words, I guess what I'm trying to say is, while you hear a lot in the recovery community about doing service through AA, we feel it's equally important, if not more so, to do your service work outside of Alcoholics Anonymous. Mm-hmm. Don't just say, oh, I set up chairs at a meeting, therefore I was of service today. It's much more important to get involved with the Red Cross, with Habitat for Humanity, we feel, because that mainstreams and normalizes the alcohol and reduces the alcoholic and reduces his stigma.
Right.
Whereas sticking around the rooms of recovery, it's more comfortable and an easier, softer path to service, but you don't get nearly the payoff.
Right, because everybody's there for the same reason. But if you could integrate yourself back into a community of normalcy, of what everybody else is, everybody has their own thing going on, but you're part of the bigger community, that I think is more supportive, because you have a lot more support coming from all different directions without the stigma or the shame attached to it.
Yeah, it's a little riskier, but there's a bigger payoff. And you know, one of the interesting things that we found out along the way was that looking at service, we found, and this is something we tell our guys, when they're looking for opportunities to be of service, the mission of the service that you're doing is secondary to how well organized the organization is around working with volunteers. Mm-hmm. So here's what I mean by that. I won't name the organization, but there's a teaching ranch nearby Carbondale, which focuses totally on sustainability. Their mission is to educate people about sustainability. We thought this place is going to rock. So we took a bunch of our guys out there and had them do about, you know, for I guess it was 3 or 4 months of work. And they just were sort of digging potatoes and left by themselves, and nobody explained what the bigger picture was. Meanwhile, we also plugged them into Adopt the Highway, which, as you know, is you put on an orange vest mm-hmm. and you just walk along a stretch of highway and you pick up trash. Well, they loved the Adopt a Highway, and they hated the Sustainability Ranch. And we thought, this is crazy, because one has got an educational mission and the other one's just picking up trash looking like a convict. But here's what it was. Is the volunteer coordinator at Adopt a Highway totally had her act together, organized the men well, had everybody, had a beginning, middle, and an end. Everybody knew exactly what their role was when they got there. And this wonderful, idealistic, you know, visionary educational ranch just had other volunteers that didn't really know how to manage volunteers, and everybody ended up kind of standing around feeling like they didn't know what to do. So I guess that's one piece of advice I would have for families, or, you know, for people new in recovery, is don't get hung up on the larger mission. Just find a superintendent that got their act together, you know, or a supervisor that's got their act together, and you'll have a much more rewarding experience.
Right. And I think it's a good role model, too, if you're coming back from recovery and you've got children, to get the children and your wife and everybody else involved in servicing your community, because it adds a lot of values and teaches a lot to your children as well, and you're role modeling that to give back. And I think that's a wonderful trait that you can give to anybody. Now, and thinking about families, how do you involve the client's family in their recovery, or do you?
No, it's a critical piece, of course. We have a comprehensive 4-day family program, and all family members are strongly encouraged to attend, and it's included in the client's fees, so it's free and it's paid for as many members of the family that want to come. They arrive on a Thursday, and it runs through Sunday. And it includes a lot of the traditional elements of a good family program in terms of, individual family counseling, individual one-on-one sort of fundamental education and stuff. But since our guys are jaywalkers, our program is really the been there, done that family program. Many of our families are family program savvy. They've been there because their son's been to two or three previous treatments. So what we try to do is really, and this is, I think, also a little non-traditional, is really try to build a lasting alliance among the family members who participate in our program. So a lot of the family program is facilitated and directed by family alumni. So we'll have family members of previous clients come back and coach and talk to our current family members about their experience, their positive sober outcomes, what they experienced. We spend a lot of time talking about, you know, what is Charlie going to do on day 91? Mm-hmm. What are you prepared to do to talk about your recovery? And how can you set a boundary? And so it's focused on boundaries and communication. We don't do a lot of painful, regressive, digging into family of origin and root causes. It's more forward-looking about a practical plan and a design going forward. Mm-hmm. However, the just as with the clients, the role of the staff at Jaywalker is not to foster an individual one-on-one relationship, a therapeutic alliance between the therapist and the counselor. Between the therapist and the patient. It's to facilitate trust and intimacy among the peer group. Mm-hmm. So we do that with the family program as well, and try to get these family members to talk to, stay in touch with, and listen to each other. Not focus on Charlie, but focus on each other and how you're going to support each other going forward.
And I think that's really important, especially if you're looking at your husband or your dad relapsing all the time and leaving the family, and how do you trust him to stay sober? You want him sober at your high school graduation. You want a sober husband that actually is able to go to work and maintain a job and help maintain the family. And it's building up that trust, again, that this person is capable of doing that. And I think, again, that goes back to setting those expectations of realizing they can handle more challenges than you think you can. They can.
It's true. And the one caveat, the one thing that gives them, you know, the strength to handle those risks and that take those challenges is the peer group. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we are fortunate that when our guys come into our somewhat open container, there's an unfortunate term, but we'll call it the open container or the open community model. Mm-hmm. They come in with a peer group that's really, really strong and has you know, commonly held values and is well established and supported by an alumni group. The problem is if they relocate back to Toledo or back to Los Angeles or wherever they're going back to, they need to really, really do a lot of work to reestablish that support group. They can handle anything, even going to college and staying sober, but they can't do it until or unless they recreate, you know, the safety of an intrinsic container, which is a positive peer group. And if you're going to move and switch zip codes, the family has to be on board and the client has to be on board with job one is going to be to rebuild a group of guys, at least three or four guys, not just a sponsor in AA, but three or four guys who, you know, really have your back and are going to be there with you through this difficult phase.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, to readjust to reality and the world back at home. Absolutely. I have a comment and a question, guest question that came in. One of our guest comments is, I'm a recovering alcoholic of 5 years this May. The havoc I caused my wife and daughter was irreparable. Every day that passes, I wish I had taken my life more seriously, as it cost me my marriage, the respect of my daughter, and two terrific jobs. It was not until I received a DUI that ended up with me in jail for 30 days that I became sober enough to stop blaming everyone else for my condition. I want to applaud your efforts out there, as it was also AA and a community program in Los Angeles that gave me the daily strength to make it over the tough spots. Is that a common occurrence of the people that you have coming in that may have lost a lot before they came there?
Wow, I just got the chills listening to that. There's so much humility in that person's statement. There's, you know, looking at his part and what damage I caused, and there's pain but also hope going forward. I am so grateful when I hear people able to, you know, it's sort of like the message we give our guys that, you know, addiction is not your fault, but it's damn sure your problem, and you've got to own the problem to change the problem. And that's what I hear in that statement. So I just, yes, that's what we see coming out of our program, but if that were the damage, and absolutely, but ownership of the problem is a big challenge for our guys coming in, seeing that it was their choices that led to their consequences, number one, and number two, this weird myth that we all hold on to, that I might be screwing up my life, but it's my life and it's my choice, and it's really not affecting others. Those are two of the things that we spend a lot of time. There's 20 to 25 hours a week of process and group therapy in various combinations of individual and group therapy to try to break through those secondary systems of denial, that I'm really not hurting anybody else.
Right.
And you can see that gentleman had broken through all of that and was going to have a lot of freedom when he did.
And hopefully has a chance to rebuild the respect of his daughter so he could, you know,
save
that relationship.
Yeah.
Yeah, might not be able to save the marriage, but maybe you could gain back your daughter. But that takes time, and it takes living your new life and the new program so she could trust that you have changed.
And you and I have both seen completely counterintuitive, ridiculous miracles happen when people just get out of their own way and stop the damage. It's not a guarantee, and there's no promise, and nobody's given a contract that they'll live happily ever after. But that said, boy, have I seen marriages reconciled and custodies, yet, like you said, custodies regained. I mean, the idea that I've done so much damage that it's irreparable and I'll never get custody again, that is very real, a very real perception of many of our guys and many of the people in early recovery. But boy, have I seen that switched around, you know, one day at a time.
And I don't want to cut you off, but we only have about a minute, and I've got one more guest question for you. Alcohol has been a devastating disease in my family. In my own family, it's been my observation that for most of this, it's a very progressive condition that does not firmly take hold until after the age of 40. My family were functional alcoholics, which is why it was so difficult to get them to admit that they had a problem. Two died of cirrhosis of the liver, two of cancer, but they were also smokers, one of a heart attack before they were 65 years old. My question is, how can a family member make an impression on their loved ones with this specific diagnosis to achieve change? And I know we only have a minute, and that's a big question, but in a nutshell.
I'll put it this way. It's just a little bit of a shift. But when you hear a 23-year-old or 25-year-old say he's a grateful recovering heroin addict, crack addict, or meth addict, that's exactly what they're talking about, because that accelerates the consequences so you don't get that 20-year slow burn of a functioning alcoholic. And it is a vexing problem. If it takes 25 years until you're in your 40s to manifest consequences that get people alarmed enough to intervene, then you have that the dynamic that that caller was talking about. Mm-hmm. And so the obvious answer is you just have to set a boundary and a standard earlier on to say what you're willing to accept and not willing to accept with someone else's behavior.
Right, right. Well, today we're talking to Bobby Ferguson. He is the founder and CEO of Jaywalker Lodge in Carbondale. And if people wanted to get a hold of your lodge or get more information, can they go to your website? And if so, what is it?
Oh, thanks. Yeah, we're at jaywalkerlodge.com. And I always say Jaywalker is spelled like a bad pedestrian. So, and that's where people will find all that they want to know. And I would say we do refer a lot of folks out as well based on, you know, we treat a narrow profile of guy, and not mm-hmm. everybody fits the profile. But if it's not right for your guy, we'll help him find the right place.
Well, that's great. Well, thank you so much for joining us today on Answers for the Family, and we'll be back next week for more. Thank you, Bobby, and have a great week, and keep up the good work at your program.
Thank you, Melody. Great to be on.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Dr. Melody Fox, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Raising children is a tough job. The job is even harder due to all the distractions, temptations, and dangers facing teens and their parents in our modern age. Some of these children are especially challenging and make such poor decisions as teens that their parents fear for their child's safety and future. I'm Lon Woodbury, and as an independent educational consultant, in my 22 years of practice as Woodbury Reports, we have worked to help hundreds of parents individually throughout the country who fear for their child's future. We also have an extensive website, strugglingteens.com, that provides as much objective information as we can to help parents. And we produce an LA Talk Radio show interviewing leading professionals who are helping parents right after Answers for the Family. If you have a child whose decisions make their future in doubt, and you are looking for help, you can call me at 208-267-5550, and I'll be glad to try to help you. Or check my website, strugglingteens, that's one word, .com.